Good afternoon. Please be seated. The next case on the en banc schedule is Fong Vu, is that correctly pronounced?
Fong Vu.
Versus Second Judicial District Court and Richard A. Gamick, Real Party in Interest, case number 65498. Mr. Petty, Mr. Cartledge, ready to go?
Yes.
Okay, Mr. Petty.
Good afternoon, Chief Justice Hardesty, and may it please the Court. My name is John Petty, and with me today is Ms. Kathy O'Leary, my colleague and friend. We are here on behalf of the petitioner. I'll be presenting the argument, and I'd like to reserve 4 minutes for rebuttal. Okay. I'll give you a little bit of background so you have some context for our two issues. The inquiry in an involuntary civil commitment proceeding is not a determination whether or not there was sufficient evidence to sustain the emergency admission of somebody at a hospital for evaluation, treatment, and observation. That is to say that an involuntary civil commitment proceeding is not a probable cause kind of hearing. What happens at an involuntary civil proceeding is the determination whether or not the person is does the person currently or presently meet criteria for admission, and that criteria is elsewhere defined in the statute. It's actually defined in 433A.115. Pursuant to 433A.310.1A, if any part of the criteria that's mentioned in the previous statute is not established by clear and convincing evidence, the court cannot, may not, commit someone to a mental health facility. Conversely, if every part of the criteria at issue is met by clear and convincing evidence, then the court may commit a person to the mental health facility for treatment. By the way, the commitment order that is issued by the court has a duration of 6 months. Pursuant to NRS 433A.310.1B, which is one of the primary statutes I want to talk to you about this afternoon, that commitment order that is issued by the court must be interlocutory and must not become final if within 30 days after the involuntary admission, the person is unconditionally released pursuant to 433A.390. Now, 433A.90 provides that or authorizes an unconditional release of a person who has been committed to a mental health facility if qualified persons have determined that he or she has recovered from his or her mental illness or has improved to such an extent that the person is no longer considered to present a clear and present danger of harm to himself or others. And I should note that that determination, that release, can happen any time during the six-month period. Mr. Vu, in this case, was released 12 days after he was committed by Judge Waller. He was there less than 2 weeks after the commitment order was issued by Judge Waller. So going back to Mr. Vu, one of the issues that we have presented to the court is whether or not Judge Waller manifestly abused his discretion by even committing Mr. Vu based on the evidence that was presented. So going back to that particular hearing, the district attorney sought to commit Mr. Vu on the basis of his inability to meet basic needs. It was not that he was a danger to others. It was not that he was a danger to himself in terms of suicide or cutting himself or harming himself physically. It was not that he attempted suicide. It was known that he could not meet his basic needs. Under NRS 433A.1152A, a basic needs commitment requires a finding based on clear and convincing evidence that there exists a reasonable probability that the person's death, serious bodily injury, or physical debilitation will occur within the following 30 days unless that person is committed to a mental health facility. Those nouns, death, serious bodily injury, physical debilitation, are very powerful terms when you contemplate the happening of a very serious, significant event on the person within 30 days unless that person is committed to a hospital. Because there are such powerful terms, we submit that the evidence that was presented to Judge Waller, that Drs. Piasecki and Drs. Lewis speculated that if Mr. Brewer were released from the Mental Health Institute, he might be at risk for an assault, not because he would assault somebody, but because of some inchoate notion that he might disturb or offend or perhaps...
The idea was that he would provoke an assault from someone else. His behavior was provocative, and that's what they're trying to say, right?
That's what they said, but if you look at the record also shows that he was absolutely cooperative when Dr. Piasecki interviewed him. There's no indication in the record that he was disruptive during the court proceedings, and he was there during the entire time. He was committed by the judge, and 12 days later, he's released. So the notion that he was at that time so potentially provocative that other people would attack him, I think the court can reject that as a finding based on the record.
You know, and I'm looking at the oral argument that occurred, and what strikes me is I think it was on page 55 of the hearing, and Judge Weller specifically says, I can glean there exists a reasonable probability that a serious bodily injury will occur if he is discharged soon because of the fact that that's how people have reacted to him in recent days, which makes me think that he was focusing more on his safety because of his behavior than a threat to other people. He goes on to say, clear and convincing evidence supports the following findings. There is a person whose capacity to exercise self-control, judgment, discretion in the conduct of his affairs and social relations and to care for his personal needs is diminished as a result of mental illness. Then he goes on to cite psychiatrists' findings.
Well, our position...
Doesn't that satisfy the statute if you take it on its face?
No, our position is... No, Your Honor. Our position is that... He made comments with regards to Mr. Vu's past behavior, but that doesn't necessarily mean that he is going to act in that fashion once he's released from the hospital. I mean, he makes that reference because that's the language of the statute. But the statute requires an independent finding because it's in the conjunctive and, not or, that if he's not committed, that there is a reasonable probability that within 30 days he's going to suffer death, serious bodily injury, or physical debilitation. The judge didn't make those findings. And in fact, there was no evidence. Dr. Piasecki was never asked that question, never answered it. And to the extent that Dr. Lewis answered the question, he was asked if, as a general matter, when you conduct these interviews with patients, is this the criteria that you consider? And his answer was yes. But he never tied that to Mr. Vu. So our position is that there was no evidence, let alone clear and convincing evidence, that Mr. Vu could not meet his basic needs. In fact, he had an apartment, he had cash, he could prepare meals. Dr. Lewis testified he had no reason to believe that Mr. Vu could not care for himself or feed himself. Dr. Piasecki, likewise, found that he was not a danger to himself or to others. So we think the record simply is insufficient to sustain Judge Waller's order.
Can the judge simply evaluate the facts of the case and look to the fact that he was threatening to kill people? He had blades in his pocket, which showed there was a possibility of that occurring. And in that scenario, factually, it also goes to reason that he would be in danger of some type of bodily injury to himself as somebody defending themselves.
There was no evidence that he was in a danger to himself. The box cutters that you mentioned was...
I mean, from other people and...
Well, there's no indication that he used any of those instruments, like box cutters or this gardening tool or sword, whatever you want to call it, against anybody else. In fact, had he done so, we wouldn't be here because he probably would have been arrested by the police, and we would be in a different forum. But there's no evidence whatsoever that he used these items against anybody. There is this sort of vague term that he intimidated people, but we don't know what that means. But in any event, at this particular time, at this hearing, the present inquiry was, could he meet his basic needs? And the answer, I think, based on the evidence, is yes. He had a place to live. He had food, he had shelter, he had cash. So we believe that the evidence just simply doesn't support the commitment. But if the court disagrees with us, the next thing that Judge Weller did was, is he immediately, pursuant to subsection 5 of 433A310, directed his clerk to notify the state registry that this commitment order had been had. We think that that was premature. We think that it's premature because, again, as I mentioned earlier, subsection 1B of that same statute says that a commitment order must not be final, or excuse me, is interlocutory and must become final, must not become final if the individual is released within 30 days of the commitment. And again, here, Mr. Boo was released 12 days after he was committed. So the order never became final. Our position is it didn't become final for any purpose. It didn't become final for purposes of the register requirement.
Yeah, but wouldn't the statute have put in paragraph 5 that it needed to be have become final? If they meant to draw that distinction that you're drawing, you're saying that it's interlocutory and unless it never becomes final, then it doesn't count and shouldn't be reported. But I think if they'd meant to do that, they would have written the statute differently.
See, I disagree. I think that if they had meant to carve out an exception that says this order is different than the order that's mentioned in 1B, they would have said, notwithstanding the provisions of 433.310.1B, an order issued by the court shall go. I think that they would have identified that this is somehow a separate, special kind of order that has to go, because you have in subsection 1, you have in subsection 1B, the mandate that these orders must not become final. That mandate has been in the statute since 1989. If you don't mind, I'd like to reserve my time for a rebuttal.
I have one question. Okay. When you read in reference to 433A115 sub 2A, the last part of that talks about and if there exists a reasonable probability that the person's death, serious bodily injury, or physical debilitation will occur within the next or the following 30 days. Mm-hmm. And there was testimony in the record that one of the doctors was concerned about a possible blood clot and sitting in a singular position for a long period of time. Wouldn't that testimony go to that issue?
Well, if you recall the testimony, Dr. Piasecki testified that that was a concern that had been identified. People talked to Mr. Vu, and he stopped doing it. He was sitting in a solitary kind of position, and they were concerned that it might give rise to a blood clot. They asked him not to do it, and he stopped. So it wasn't, that was the only concern, and it wasn't a concern for Dr. Piasecki. She didn't believe that he was a danger to himself by virtue of that or any other reason. So I don't think that's a pretty thin way to find danger or harm to self under the statute. Where the commanding words, the three words,
it's a category:
is death, serious bodily injury, and physical debilitation,
or
exactly. And I think that because you have that string of words, that means something. Those are very powerful terms. If I could reserve my time.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chief Justice. Members of the court, my name is Blaine Cartledge. I'm Deputy District Attorney with Washoe County. And I think I'd like to take the last half of the petitioner's arguments first and then return to the evidence.
I'd like to hear you address why you think this should not be here on a petition for writ relief. The opposition makes the point that you feel he has an adequate remedy.
That's correct.
Briefly, I don't want to take up too much time on that, but I'd like to be convinced on that point.
Certainly. I'll shoot right to it. The order is interlocutory. The statute calls a commitment order interlocutory. Interlocutory, as far as we know, is an appellate term. It means you can't appeal. It's Blacks defines it as interim or temporary. So it can't be appealed. So what's the petitioner left with?
Really?
To address their commitment. The only civil manner in which their liberty can be taken is a mental health commitment. It's a serious matter. How do we address the petitioner's right to be able to, in NRS 433, not 433A, but 433, the legislature provided for the writ of habeas corpus. That's the only remedy that's provided. That's the kind of remedy that should be brought to remove the body
But once he's out, and if we credit your argument that even a non-final order should be reported, what remedy does he have to get that report unwound if the evidentiary predicate for it was inadequate, yet in the meantime he's been released, so he doesn't need to have his body liberated.
He
needs his record liberated.
He was released 12 days after.
Right, my point.
They could have brought the writ of habeas corpus before if they thought the evidence was inadequate. They could have brought the writ of habeas corpus within the 12 days that he remained after the commitment.
So your point is it's only habeas? All the other writs are
correct.
Denied somebody in this situation?
I don't think the writ of mandamus, these extraordinary remedies apply in this case because there's an adequate remedy provided by the legislature.
And that's the habeas remedy.
Right, within the specific statutory schemas.
And the limit on its duration, given the facts of this case, are not troubling to you and do not then allow for the extraordinary writ of mandamus?
It is a concern, but the whole process is accelerated. We have to get to court following the filing of a petition within 5 days, 5 judicial days. The whole process is jammed in, is accelerated, and I think the writ has to accompany that. But in terms of the petitioner's argument about the nature of the order and whether or not the word final can be imported into the statute so that the order cannot be registered with this, or sent down to the central registry until the 31st day, and then only if the patient remains at the facility. That argument dangles on the premise that all of the orders, all of the other orders under Nevada law that are required to be sent to the Nevada registry, central registry, are different and must be treated differently than this mental health commitment order. The guardianship orders, the not guilty by insanity orders, and the criminally incompetent to proceed orders are all required to be sent to the registry immediately and are. But because we're asked to import the word final into the registration section of the statute, commitment orders are suddenly treated differently. If the legislature intended that result, I think this is probably the most obscure way they could have done it. We should not accept the invitation of the petitioner to rewrite the statute by importing that word final. And I cite there the petitioner's reply brief case of Holiday Retirement Corporation, 2012, noting that it is the prerogative of the legislature, not this court, to change or rewrite a statute. What is plain on the face is the language in several statutes before us, which permits each statute to stand on its own and not be rendered a nullity. The interlocutory sentence has meaning. The registry statute has independent meaning. And the confidentiality and seal and as if never occurred statute has meaning and stands on its own. The interlocutory statute or sentence proclaims that the order is interim, cannot be appealed, stands on its own, it's not a nullity. The registry statute has an independent mandatory obligation upon the court to send the order, just like in all the other statutes regarding the criminal, in the criminal context and the guardianship context. And the confidentiality seal and not exist statute at 433A.715 declares that the entire proceeding is confidential, the court shall seal the record, and it's as if the commitment never occurred. But the legislature also dictated that the registration of the order back in 310, it's section 5, that the registration of the commitment order shall occur notwithstanding 433A.715. I think the language is plain, it's not vague, and it needs no importing into the registration statute of the word final. And just because the same word order is used in the two statutes, the interlocutory one and the registration one, does not support the leap that one preconditions the other. This court condition proceeding, the brief argues, for the petitioner. It's a leap, and it produces an absurd result that contradicts the plain language of the statute and the whole statutory scheme of 433A. It produces an absurd result because it singles out commitment orders of all the orders required under Nevada law to be sent to the Central Register. And it cuts off the federal and state law purposes of disqualifying persons from owning or possessing a weapon who are adjudicated mentally ill. That is the simple and plain language and purpose of the laws. Those laws seek to prevent the type of Virginia Tech or Texas or Santa Barbara killings. What the Brady Bill and the NICS Improvement Amendments Act on the federal level did, along with Nevada's registration statute, were to require registration of the disqualification so to be caught in the background check, and that's all. It's important that our focus be on the disqualifying event we would submit, the commitment adjudication, not the registration of the order. It's the adjudication that must be discovered, regardless of the technical procedural posture of the order of commitment. But the petitioner's argument elevates the technical form of an interlocutory order over the independent substance of the mandatory duty upon the courts to send the order to the registry. This elevates the meaning of interlocutory to a significance I'm unfamiliar with. I don't think has ever been seen. Interlocutory, as we've talked about now, is an appeal concept defined as interim or temporary. It's never been applied as a precondition to the force and effect of an order. So in commitment cases, if petitioner's argument prevails, is the hospital required to obey the commitment order? If it's interlocutory, temporary, and has no force and effect. I submit the two statutes are not intertwined. They operate independent of each other, and each statute is preserved from being rendered a nullity. So habeas corpus relief may be invoked by the patient before and after a commitment order. That's at 433.464. And the legislature, as I've discussed already, designed in 715 that these proceedings are as if they never occurred, except in connection with guns and employment. But the point being, the legislature also dictated that in spite of that, notwithstanding that, in 433A.310 Section 5, we're going to require the court to send the registration to the Central Registry, notwithstanding, the legislature said. So it's clear. And the legislature has spoken many times that it's illegal to own or possess a gun if you are declared mentally ill or committed, and the discovery of that by registration of the related order is consistent and is an independent mandate upon the courts, regardless of the interlocutory nature of the order. This is consistent with and serves our state law and federal laws, which have long considered it a crime for the mentally ill persons to own or possess a weapon. The federal law is the Gun Control Act of 1968, cited in Chapter 18 U.S.C. and also in Chapter 27 CFR. And in Nevada, at NRS 202.362A, it's long been held a crime to possess or own a firearm if you are mentally ill. And as I've mentioned, there's a long list of orders that are required to be registered.
Counsel, this line of argument that you're making is very persuasive, but doesn't that point back to the concern that was raised on behalf of Mr. Vu that the proceedings didn't make appropriate findings as to his condition to himself?
I think the evidence was beyond a reasonable doubt. There was no evidence presented contradicting any of the evidence that we presented. There was no expert testimony presented.
Does that mean you can't have a failure proof, though? I mean,
the evidence presented, though, was danger to others. And counsel was pointing out what's required was danger to himself.
The case that was presented was a basic needs case, number four on the list, what we consider number four, which is danger to others or homicidal tendencies. The case presented was on basic needs, and basic needs includes in the definition at 115 safety, and self-protection. Dr. Piasecki, the psychiatrist, both experts and the only ones produced, both stated that, and I'm reading from page 44 of the transcript, Dr. Piasecki's examination starting in line 21, so I believe that the perceptions that people have that he is threatening to them, as well as his inability to communicate in an organized fashion, put him at risk for his own safety and well-being, that if somebody feels threatened by him, they may respond in a way that affects his well-being.
So if somebody has Tourette's and they have periodic outbursts of vulgarity and aggressiveness, should we lock them up?
Tourette's may not be a mental illness. As far as I know, it's not in the DSM. I'm not the expert. But I think the point is that...
But I mean, people have the right to be out among us who are mentally ill so long as they're not under these statutes. We don't just lock up anyone who exhibits aberrant behavior.
Correct.
That is the product of mental illness. And my concern, and I think Justice Douglas is getting to it as well, is it isn't that he was a threat to others. That's not the statutory basis that he was committed. The statutory basis was that his behavior was likely to provoke some kind of threat back to him that in turn would cause him to react or have them hurt him. Other people might hurt him because he was so provocative. That's a bit troubling to me.
That's a bit troubling?
It is, because I on this record, I'm not seeing anything to substantiate that. It's a clear and convincing evidence standard. I understand that he's disturbing to be around. But if we credit your reading of that statute, then is there any difference between threat to others and this, you're going to provoke a response from others because you're so bizarre?
There might be a difference in the way experts read and apply the basic needs of safety and self-protection. There might be a difference reasonable minds can draw. But the testimony of the only experts in the case, the court-appointed experts, was unanimous. Again, reading
well,
from
no,
the page.
We can have a failure of proof. You could have, I mean, they didn't have to disprove what you put forward. It could be that your proof didn't meet the standard, and that's why what I'm trying to get at is, did you meet the statutory standard with your case evidence that justified committing this man under he can't care for his own well-being because he's likely to... I think they have a point, and that's the one I'm trying to get you to focus on the statutory standards.
I could offer only that this gentleman was off his medications in the family for the first time in their life with them, had to obtain a TPO and ask him not to move back into the house, did not want him to come back into the home. They were severely afraid of him. One of the doctors said this is a used language about a serious danger this gentleman poses. When he's off his meds, he's paranoid, he's delusional, he's reacting to hallucinations, he's under the command of those hallucinations.
So that would be a threat to others then.
Carrying swords.
But is that a threat to others?
You can put yourself in such a state of risk of your own safety and self-protection, I would argue that you are a high risk of harm to yourself.
Because you're going to bring down upon yourself adverse reactions from other people?
Serious physical debilitation, if not death.
But, Chief, may I ask a question?
Yes.
I don't think I disagree with much of what you just said, except that the statute says it differently. Prosecuting attorney must demonstrate by clear and convincing evidence that a reasonable probability that death, serious bodily injury, or physical debilitation would occur without admission. You're talking about things that might have happened as a result of his bizarre behavior. And I have to agree with Justice Pickering that while troubling and disturbing, what we might speculate about his behavior or what reaction others might have to it, I don't see in this record clear and convincing evidence that the statute requires. Or am I citing to something that is...
I can only offer to you the interpretation and application of the evidence of the two court-appointed doctors. And if I could, for just a moment, be able to cite to you again page 44 at the bottom onto page 45, where Dr. Piasecki goes on to say that if somebody feels threatened by him, they may respond in a way that affects his well-being. They may feel as though they need to defend themselves against the threat, and they may not have a mental health tech or the Sparks Police Department. They may not choose those as their interventions. And later she goes on and says, as does Dr. Lewis, that they're not, that folks around him, like family and friends, are not trained and could end up having to defend themselves when
Sparks starts. Sounds pretty speculative to me. I don't dispute that it could happen, but it doesn't sound like clear and convincing evidence having been presented. And that's a difference of opinion.
It rises to the level of clear and convincing. When the only record that's available demonstrates that he's off his meds, delusional, acting under command hallucinations with access to weapons and could use those weapons, and the doctors are sitting there trying to evaluate whether this is such a high risk that in the next 30 days, if we let him go now, could he go after his family? Could he be under a command hallucination the next time the neighbor walks by? He's acting out. There's true, he doesn't present with a pattern or a history, but is that part of what clear and convincing evidence is? I would offer no. As a result of the school incident here in Reno, a psychiatrist was interviewed from Columbia University who stated that statements that reflect homicidal ideation or threatening behavior or something serious enough that we should be intervening. I think that applies.
Counsel, unfortunately, we have a lot of people with fancy titles that make those statements on a regular basis, and they're not locked up. So that's kind of problematic.
Thank you.
Any other questions for Mr. Carnage? All right. Mr. Petty, the balance of your time is 2:27.
I'm going to talk faster than usual. I just want to say that some of the concerns that Mr. Carlos brought up, he conflates with the actual issue that was before the court. The concerns that brought him into the hospital for an emergency admission, there's no question they were sufficient to bring him for emergency admission. The question is, under the state's theory, did they establish clear and convincing evidence that he could not meet his basic needs, and this record simply doesn't support it. Justice Pickering, when you were talking about statutory construction, and we're all textualists now, I'm told, and I believe that, I suggested to you that if the legislature wanted to have carved out Section 5 from 1B, it could have said notwithstanding using that language. If you take a look at subsection 5, that's exactly what they did with NRS 433A715, when it says the court shall, comma, notwithstanding the provisions of NRS 433A715 cause. So if the legislature wanted to carve out a difference, they could have done that. They did it with 715. They could have done it with 3101B, but they did not. That means, and as my friend Mr. Carlos keeps saying, using the word statutes, we're talking about a statute. We're talking about subsections in the same statute. And this court has said,
but that same statute uses order capaciously to encompass both an interlocutory order and a final order. And to me, that's a problem for your argument.
I understand. And my argument, though, is that the order has to be, the word order has to mean the same thing. It has to bear the same meaning. And that means that if in the factual situation somebody is released before that 3-day time period, there is no final order. And that means there is no final order for subsection 5.
But that's there was an interlocutory one.
That's our argument. I'm sorry?
There was an interlocutory one.
I understand that. But then it says it must not become final. Those words have to have meaning. This court in Charlie Brown versus Construction Company versus Boulder City said there is a presumption that every word, phrase, and provision in the statute has meaning. This court reiterated it in Boulder v. State, 120 Nevada. Statutes must be construed as a whole and not read in such a way that would render words or phrases superfluous and make provisions nugatory. If you take out must not become final from Section 5, you annihilate the meaning of those five words in 1B.
Except for that the person doesn't have to stay for 6 months.
No. it is interlocutory, which means they could, I mean, the person can be committed for 30, it could be, get into the, could be, beyond the 30 days, could be 31, 32, 33 days, and still get released by the hospital under 310-490, but that would be a final order, subject to the reporting provisions of subsection 5. And that's not inconsistent with the federal regulations. I know my friend wants to argue about potential federal funding issues, but Nevada is a beneficiary of federal funds because Nevada incorporated a relief from liabilities program, which means that it indicates that Congress has treated people who have been institutionalized more favorably than other persons who might be prohibited from owning guns by virtue of some law. And that observation, and it's not in the brief, but there was a case that was decided last December, 2014, out of the Sixth Circuit. Tyler versus Hillsdale County Sheriff Department, 775 F3rd 308, Sixth Circuit, 2014. And it points out that those relief from disability programs indicate Congress's favorable treatment for those who have been institutionalized. And if that's the case on the back end, we think, by analogy, it should be the case on the front end, which means that only final orders should be subject to subsection 5. And those orders that may not become final because the person was released should not be subject to subsection 5.
Let me ask you, if I may, Chief, one more question before you step down. And it's a policy question as to the reporting requirements. What was that designed to protect?
The reporting requirements?
Yeah.
It was designed to give access to the federal government through state information those persons who should not be able to carry guns or purchase guns.
Okay, so doesn't it make sense in the way the statute is written, if they're released within 12 days and the order never became final, they've still been committed and they would still, the way the statute, at least the way I look at it, would apply to where it needs to be reported. It's not like there was an adjudication that there was no longer a mental issue or mental illness, but perhaps problem there was resolved prior to 30 days. But why shouldn't that report, considering the policy here?
Well, on a policy basis, I would say that if you have a final order, an individual has been past the 30 days, so you absolutely have a final order, there is a greater reason for the state to want to share that information with the federal government, aside from the funding issues that are attached to it. But when somebody has been committed to a hospital, like, for example, this record here, where the record doesn't seem to support the commitment, and the person is released almost immediately after that commitment, because the concerns that the court says exist obviously don't, why should that person be precluded from the opportunity, if he or she wants, to have a gun or purchase a gun, simply because of a rushed commitment order that never became final? As a policy reason, particularly now, where in the last several years, the Second Amendment has become a huge right issue in the nation.
Well, and I didn't see it fully developed as to what the remedy would be as to pulling back the order that was already sent.
Well, the remedy would be, I'm sorry, Justice.
No, go ahead.
I apologize. I didn't mean to talk with you. The remedy would be to require the judge to call back that order and have the registry reflect that the commitment order was invalid. It was void. And therefore,
which
should
be
not
an issue, but I'm not sure it was fully developed here.
Well, that would be the remedy that we'd be asking, that the court remand the matter. Whether the court finds that the evidence was insufficient, or whether the court finds that the interlocutory order is not an appropriate order for subsection 5, I think the court should direct the district court, Judge Waller, to call back that notification to the registry because it was improvidently issued.
Counsel, there's also the NAC provision that would allow the individual to challenge that with other documentation by appearing before them and submitting something.
Are you talking about the three-year challenge requirement?
179A-270 provision that by filling out forms, paying the fee, giving his ability to come come to that repository and, in essence, show the, in essence, inaccuracy of the record?
Well, I think that notwithstanding that provision, I think that because the evidence was insufficient to support the commitment in the first place, that the things that flowed from that with regards to the registry report, the district court should be called upon to simply, should simply call that back. There may be provisions for an individual to go and make their independent case, but in this case, we think an appropriate remedy would be for the court to call that information back as improvidently ordered.
So even if a commitment were supported by substantial evidence, and that may be the case here, the court would not notify the repository of someone that they've committed for 30 days.
On the 31st day. That's our position, yes.
The repository would have no idea that a person properly committed.
And that, Justice Hardstein, and that person, because he has been committed and is still in custody, is in the care and custody of, for example, here, the Northern Nevada Mental Health Services. So he would not or she would not be out in the community. So a 30-day time frame.
Unless they escaped.
I'm sorry?
Unless they escaped.
You know, I have been handling mental health cases at Northern Nevada Mental Health since about 2003. I have never, I am unaware of an escape. I know it goes outside the record, but I'm aware of it.
I think until Sunday, Silver State Academy made that same record. That's all, Mr. Petty. Thank you very much.
I thank you, and I was going to say, I don't know anything about that. Thank you.
All right, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Cartledge. Ms. O'Leary, always nice to see you. The matter will stand submitted. We appreciate your arguments and brief.